Settling in and kicking off a brand new week with you Monday, May 20th, 2024 on Connecticut Today. We started the program looking at the continued controversy surrounding graduation ceremony remarks from Kansas City Chiefs kicker Harrison Butker earlier in the month. Quinnipiac University Assistant Professor of Film, TV, and Media Art Blythe Frank joined us live from France to talk about her trip with students to the Cannes Film Festival, while Connecticut News Junkie, columnist, and Substack.com blogger Terry Cowgill stopped by for his weekly update on some of the big state and national stories he's following.
You know, I'm really starting to think, especially after this past weekend of reading all the responses that are still coming in to that Harrison Butker commencement address that the Chiefs kicker gave a couple of weeks back at a very, very small private Catholic college in Missouri, Benedictine College. I'm really starting to think, honestly, and I'm not saying this for effect, I'm starting to think that his commencement address is going to go down in history as one of the most consequential and necessary commencement addresses that we've ever seen. You know, normally you don't hear a lot about those because they tend to be a lot of people saying the same thing. And, you know, I'm not a big one. I've told you this previously. I'm not a real big person for trying to take a commencement address and turn it into something it shouldn't be. In other words, I generally don't like, whether it's a sports figure, an entertainment figure, a singer, a dancer, an actor, a politician, active or retired, I don't like them making it about them. I think the commencement address or commencement address says should be generally about the happiness of a commencement day or what the graduates should be feeling, whether it's gratitude, who they should thank, whatever. You and I have probably been through this at least a few times in our lives, and whether it's ourselves, the person who went on to be our partner or our husband or our wife maybe or our kids or grandkids, whatever. We know what we would like to hear in a commencement address. And I'm kind of ambivalent about what Harrison Butker said about, you know, women trying to balance off a future career, a business career, a professional career with being a mother, his remarks about the LGBTQ community, his, you know, general remarks about the Pope and abortion and all that. That's fine. I mean, he can have his opinions. But here's the thing. I'm adult enough to say, all right, maybe I agree with some of that. Maybe I don't agree with some of that. Life goes on. But I got to tell you, the reason that I think that's going to go down as a seminal moment, it may not go down as a seminal moment for what he actually said, but I think it will go down as somewhat of a seminal moment in society, particularly in the U.S., for the reactions to that and the continued psychosis by some people on the left here. Oh, my God. This speech, this remark, him being a devout conservative Catholic to a bunch of other devout conservative Catholics, is still driving people nuts. And it's a thing of beauty. You know why? Because I don't think we're driven nuts enough in society. We all settle in to our little, nice, warm, comfy cocoons, you and I that are on the left, on the right, up, down, male, female, gay, and straight, and we don't want anything or anybody challenging our beliefs. Because, oh my God, how dare he say that? Oh my God, if I read one more criticism of him, how dare he say that? How dare he says that? Says who? When did all these so-called progressives who, and he's getting some flack from some, you know, conservatives as well, but who made all these people the purveyors, the imprimaturs of what should be said and not said? And I'm seeing all these petitions. Well, the Chiefs should be doing more. And how can they employ him? How can they employ a guy like Harrison Butker? How can the family of the Chiefs do this? I'll tell you how. Because you know what? It ain't about a commencement speech. It's about winning football. Let me give you an example. And this immediately popped into my head over the weekend. Now, you have all these, and I'm doing the air quotes now, women's groups. You know, the women's groups that, you know, will react to this, but won't react to biological men who still have their junk attached to them, you know, defeating and pounding women in sports. But let me just use the phrase women's groups here. And for a lot of you ladies, women's out there, women's kinds out there, you know the ones I'm talking about. Now, you know, National Organization for Women, the Million Woman March or something like that. Here's what the Harrison Butker speech did. It really put a highlight again on how hypocritical people can be and how selective outrage is not only a thing, it's a big thing. You'll only be outraged, a lot of you people on the left, you'll only be outraged if it suits you. But the stuff you shouldn't be outraged at, that may be a lot worse than what Harrison Butker said or firmly believes, the guy, good for him, is not backing down. Don't get bullied by the mob. You know, the stuff you should be concerned with, you're not. Let me give you an example. Now, you have all these petitions out there, and 300,000 people are telling the Chiefs, get rid of Harrison Butker. Okay, because largely what he said, right? He didn't physically assault anybody. Largely what he said. Oh, well, yes, Paul, he shouldn't have said that. The National Football League, the Kansas City Chiefs, this guy should not be allowed to play. Okay. Were any of you people upset with the Chiefs when they used to employ a guy by the name of Tyreek Hill? That ring a bell? Oh, yeah. He's with the Dolphins now. Almost landed with the Jets, left the Chiefs for a big free agent deal a couple of seasons ago. Well, what does that have to do with Harrison Butker, Paul? I'll tell you, because both Tyreek Hill at one time and Harrison Butker currently, they both were employed by the Kansas City Chiefs. Now, you have people right now saying, get rid of Butker. How dare he play? The league can't have him in there. This thing. Okay, but you know who the league still has in there? Tyreek Hill. Tyreek Hill at one time was willingly signed to ply his trade as probably one of the top five receivers in the NFL. Some would say the best, maybe, by the Kansas City Chiefs. Here's a little passage on Tyreek Hill that nobody cared about when he was catching touchdowns for the Kansas City Chiefs. Now, these same people are losing their sleep and losing their it over Harrison Butker, but did they have anything to say about this? Tyreek Hill played just one season for the Cowboys at Oklahoma State University thanks to his arrest on a domestic violence charge. Hill's girlfriend at the time, Crystal Espinal, was 8 weeks pregnant with his child. She told police an argument late on the night of December 12, 2014, at Hill's Stillwater home escalated to physical violence. Espinal said she was choked by Hill, who also punched her in the stomach and in the face. Still in pain in her stomach, she said she was concerned about the baby. Hill spent the night in jail, and on the next day he was charged with felony domestic assault and battery by strangulation. That day, Oklahoma State announced it had dismissed Hill from the football and the track programs. Oklahoma State University does not tolerate domestic abuse or violence, the school said in a statement. Hill initially pled not guilty in August, represented by a new defense attorney after reportedly failing to meet monetary obligations with Cheryl Ramsey. Hill pleaded guilty to the charges and, thanks to a plea agreement with the DA's office, received 3 years of probation. Now, here's my question. And it's a simple question, and maybe you have the answer, maybe you don't. I'm speaking a little rhetorically here. All these people who want to run Harrison Butker off the team in our oh, my God. How can this man wear the uniform of the Kansas City Chiefs? Sports is supposed to be a unifying force. It's supposed to bring us together. How can you let him continue in your employment when he said what he said? Well, you didn't say much when they employed a guy who beat up and strangled his pregnant girlfriend. Now did you? Now did you? But because Harrison Butker said something that, let's face it, with a lot of these people here who are still apoplectic over this, because Harrison Butker said something that may have hit a nerve with you, maybe, in a scenario that concerns something that he spoke about, if you're Catholic or not, a pregnancy maybe was involved, something to do with your employment situation, maybe a dispute you've been in with a spouse about working or staying home, because he said something that may, whether you like it or not, have touched a nerve in you, you don't want him around. Many of you, I can't say all of you, to be fair, but you don't want him around, do you? And you're going to continue this incessant garbage of feigning all this outrage because he said something that he said of his own free will, and apparently a lot of people in that audience agreed with. Well, it's not good that he be around in the Chiefs organization. Well, okay, and I come back to my initial point. Did you say anything when the Chiefs employed a guy who punched and strangled his pregnant girlfriend? Where was your outrage then? Where was it? You know where it was? You didn't care. If you knew about it, you didn't care. You didn't care. Because Tyreek Hill scores touchdowns. I'm a movie guy. I know I have all the streaming services too, but I've always loved going to the movies. I go as often as I can. I'm usually good, especially in the summer, for two or three movies a month. I'm a guy that still likes to see some stuff on a big screen with a big theater size dimension to it and the nice comfy seats and the great sound system and everything. So I follow the movie industry. My son's in the entertainment industry. Told you he works on Broadway, you know, movies maybe down the road. But joining us right now is Quinnipiac University Assistant Professor of Film, TV, and Media Art and Director of the Grad Cinematic Production Management Program, Blythe Frank. She's on a trip with some college students at the Cannes Film Festival, and you know how influential Cannes can be regarding movies that you and I get to see, and sometimes we don't. Professor Frank, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Hi, Paul. I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good. Now, are you still there? Are you still in Cannes?
I am. It's about 10:15 p.m. in Cannes right now. I've just stepped out of an event to have a conversation with you.
Well, thank you for doing it. I know I understand the time difference, but this is cool. You know, the Cannes Film Festival, Professor, like I said, especially for somebody like me who's a movie guy, it's kind of one of those places like, wow, this is fascinating. I'll never get there, but it's an artistic thing as well as a business thing, isn't it?
100%, and it's really why I created this program to bring the students to Cannes, because it's one of the biggest film markets in the world, and you know, not only is it one of the top five film festivals, but it also has all the businesses, all the sales companies, the distribution companies. They come here to do business, to sell and buy films, and to make connections and put financing together. So it's all about having a front row to seeing how the business actually operates.
You know, I've talked to people inside the industry before, Professor, and one thing they hammer home to me, and I think you're saying the same thing, you can have the greatest movie of all time. I mean, you can have Citizen Kane times 10 or The Godfather times 100, but if you don't have that distribution deal and the business deal, nobody's going to see it, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are a lot of factors that go into making a film that is viable for distribution, and that's a lot of what we teach in the program at Quinnipiac. You have to understand how the business operates. It's a holistic ecosystem that starts from the moment that you choose the script that you want to produce or you want to direct or write, et cetera. And what's the genre? Who's involved? What's the creative package? And you have to create, you know, this, you know, a creative package that is going to be something that is sellable in the market, that is going to find its own platform, whether it's a theatrical release, whether it is going to just be released on streaming. But there are different pathways for films to be released or television shows. But you have to understand what it is that you're making in order for it to find its home and basically make your money back. That's the goal.
So I guess what you're saying, Professor, and I hear this from my son. He does some work on Broadway. Am I hearing that you could have the greatest artistic piece here, but it's a product? And if not enough people or a distribution company wants to hook in with that product to make money commercially, it's a tough go.
Absolutely. You know, the business is all about the nexus between the creative and the business. And you really have to understand what it is that you're selling. It is a product. At the end of the day, we want to put, you know, impactful, amazing stories into the world. That has its place. It's something that we need to partake in, but we also need to understand if you want to make a living in this industry, you have to understand where you can make money, how that happens, and the people that you need to be in business with.
And you're there with some students from Quinnipiac, I guess, and some other colleges as well. What have they said to you? How are they soaking this in? Have there been a lot of, oh, wow, like light bulb moments so far?
We are partnered with Colgate University and with the Gotham Film and Media Institute out of New York. And I am here with my esteemed colleague, Professor Mary Schmidt, who's in the room with me right now. There have been some really amazing moments, actually, because this program is an add-on to a class that I teach on distribution, sales, and marketing. And students are like, okay, I got kind of what we were saying in class, but now all the pieces have come together. Mm. I really understand what it was that you were talking about when they see how it operates firsthand.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you been able in your students to see a lot of these films? Like, what did I read today, knowing you were coming on? There's some sort of a horror film with Demi Moore that got like a 15-minute ovation. Did you see that? What about Megalopolis, Coppola? I mean, any of these you can tell us about or not?
There's so many interesting things happening here at the festival, and we've been seeing a lot of different films.
Mm-hmm.
It's sometimes tough to get tickets, but The Substance, which is Demi Moore's film, our students are actually queuing in line to go into a screening right
now.
Wow.
Okay.
And so I think it's pretty graphic, and there was apparently a woman who fainted in
the screening. Oh, come on, really?
It's pretty graphic.
Wow.
But I think there's a lot of very provocative films in the festival this year. In Megalopolis is also one that mm-hmm. has been, there's a lot of passion projects that are in the festival this year, not only Megalopolis, but Kevin Costner's Horizon. And, our students also got to do the red carpet with Nicolas Cage's The Surfer the other mm-hmm. evening. So it's a really interesting mix of films this year. We've also been, just participating in a lot of impact producing conferences and panels. And there's an incredible immersive, VR kind of conference going on. Mm-hmm. And I have been blown away by the work that they're doing here. And it really is setting a precedent for what we should be doing in the industry and how we're going to expand and grow as filmmakers and storytellers.
You know, finally, Professor, I want to ask you, and the guest is Professor Blythe Frank with Quinnipiac University, there with a group of students from Quinnipiac and other schools and organizations at the Cannes Film Festival, and we thank her for talking with us at this late hour. How does somebody get something shown at Cannes? Now, obviously, if they're A-listers in the cast or they're an A-list producer like Francis Ford Coppola, we get that, but how do these kind of nondescript productions or buzzword productions get in there? Is it political? Is it just glad-handing? How does that happen?
It's a great question. It's bribes. No, I'm kidding. I don't know. You know, it is the, you know, it's a very delicate balance because Cannes is really known for, you know, leaning into a really diverse menu of international films, and it's very culturally deep, and I think that it shows where we are at in the world right now, and so it looks for filmmakers that are telling stories that are provocative, that are pushing the boundary of what's happening in the world today, of reading what's happening, and I think it's more about great storytelling than anything else here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I respect so much about Cannes, is that they endeavor to keep the meaning and what we do and why we do it. And the business can operate all around that. But if you do not have the cultural significance and influence in the films that are put out into the world, I think we're lost in terms of our humanity.
Yeah, one more thing I do want to ask you, it just popped into my head here. Finally, artificial intelligence, is there a worry about that, or is there maybe a way that real breathing humans in the business can work with that?
It's a big question, but what I will say is that, you know, that is another big element of the festival this year in the Marché, in terms of like AI conversations. And I believe that AI is a collaboration. I don't think that AI can be creative in the way that humans can be creative. They do not have that spark. AI is built on historical information. It's only built on what's already been done. If it doesn't have an operator, it can't actually be successful. And so I don't think we should be afraid of AI. It's going to change the world we're living in, but I think that there are a lot of positives to it. But at the end of the day, there are protocols put in place in terms of the new contracts with WGA, with the DGA, with SAG, et cetera, so that we have to protect humanity in the center of all of this. And AI can never be the creative engine for the stories that we tell.
Quinnipiac University Assistant Professor of Film, TV, and Media Art directs also the Grad Cinematic Production Management Program. Professor Blythe Frank there with some Quinnipiac students, other students in France at the Cannes Film Festival. Professor, thank you for taking the time. We know it's late there. We appreciate it. Safe travels and enjoy the rest of the festival. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. All right. There you go. Professor Blythe Frank from Quinnipiac, Assistant Prof, TV, Film, and Media Art, and she directs the Graduate Cinematic Production Management Program at Quinnipiac. Terry Cowgill joins us for his regular Monday afternoon stop by. You can read his stuff at the Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.org, and also you can read him at substack.com. His blog there is called Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Terry, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Well, not bad, thank you. I heard some discussion. I think you had a soliloquy on the car tax, and I was wondering, you know, what would replace it if the towns got rid of it.
Well, yeah,
that's as you said, it's like $1 billion that they get every year from this tax.
Yeah,
and towns don't really have a significant revenue stream other than property taxes. You know, they've got building permit fees. There's some other things, but mm-hmm. really, it's the property taxes that are huge. So if you got rid of the car tax, I assume that that would mean that real estate taxes would simply go up accordingly, right?
Unless, like I say, you know, we are, you know, I think political kryptonite, Terry, would be doing something. I'm not sure what. you do something with the sales tax? I mean, I'd like to see the numbers, but it's funny because we never, of all the taxes in the state, it's like literally like kryptonite and Superman to even say, well, maybe we adjust the sales tax a scotch. I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, well, I know in Massachusetts, they allow the towns to enact to have an add-on, mm-hmm. like 2% sales
yep.
tax,
mm-hmm.
2 percentage points onto meals taxes and hotel room taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a possibility, but the legislature is really loath to give the to take away any authority and give some of it to the towns. You know, they just don't like to do that. They're not in the business of doing that, really.
No, no. All right, let's go to some of the stuff you wrote. I'm looking at your new piece here under, of course, Substack.com, red meat for mushy moderates. You're not real thrilled. Neither are a lot of people with all this stuff surrounding whether it's junkets or flags flied upside down the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, I had written last year at this time, I was still on my high horse about Clarence Thomas and all of the, you know, the fancy, expensive vacations that he got from mm-hmm. the mega donor Harlan Crow.
Yeah.
But this most recent story about Justice Alito and flying this upside down flag, which I think you and I both know because we know something about flag etiquette. That it's generally a sign of distress, but mm-hmm. it was sort of co-opted by some of the people who were involved in the Stop the Steal movement. And this was only about 3 days before Biden's inauguration. So it was a very difficult time. And I think the problem is that there's certainly, and of course, Justice Alito, he essentially blamed his wife, which is not the first time a man has done that.
Never.
You know?
See, honey? Honey, I told you, sweetheart. See?
Yeah. But I just thought to myself, you know, look, the fact that his wife thinks this, that doesn't necessarily mean that he does.
Yeah.
But, man, when you're in a position like that, you're a Supreme Court justice. I mean, you got to go to my wife, as I pointed out in the piece, you know, when I was a local journalist here, if my wife had put up a lawn sign endorsing a candidate in our town, I would have asked her to take it down.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I do have opinions, and I'm sure Justice Alito has opinions on the Stop the Steal movement. But you have to be really careful about this stuff. It's going to taint every decision he makes
mm-hmm.
About this. It's going to make it appear as if he has prejudged it, even if he hasn't. It's going to look like it. So credibility is everything with these Supreme Court justices. And I'm afraid that Justice Alito has squandered some of that with this most recent action.
The Costa Diamantis case, which flared up about a year and a half ago when people were getting arrested and his daughter and everything and all this, it kind of settled down. But then it flared up again the past few days now with the criminal indictments and all this. And you point to a couple of pieces here. And, you know, whether you want to go back to the rolling years or whatever, Terry Cowgill, it's sad that, you know, in a state that prides itself on good government and all this, this sort of sleaze never really leaves us, does it?
No, I mean, there's a reason that the hashtag Corrupticut is trending on Twitter, right? We have a long history of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Diamantis, though, it appears that he was given wide latitude as the sort of czar of this state school construction
mm-hmm.
program that
yeah.
that gave money out to local school districts to build schools and other facilities. And he was really an independent operator. And he did, of course, he was shaking down contractors or allegedly shaking down contractors. And I looked and I read the piece in the Mirror. Of course, Kevin Rennie had a very scathing column that
mm-hmm.
pointed out all of the Lamont administration's negligence in this, and that it was well known that there were problems, and they didn't really act. And as you alluded to earlier, Diamantis' daughter got a job, $100,000 job with the state's attorney, Colangelo. I asked a friend of mine who's a retired police officer in Massachusetts, and I kind of described this to him because, you know, Diamantis it was like there was an urgency to everything he was doing in terms of shaking down these contracts. Oh, I need the money now. And I told this to my retired cop friend, and he said, that behavior is consistent with somebody who has accumulated gambling debt.
Yeah.
You know, and that's probably what all of the urgency was in his need for money, his desperate need for money. And that would make sense. It would explain a lot. It doesn't excuse anything, of course.
Sure.
But I look at that indictment, I'm trying to make sense of it. And it is really a sad thing to look at from multiple angles. But this is obviously a bad guy who did a wrong thing, and I think he's going to really pay the price, because the feds, they don't mess around when they have an indictment like that.
No, they have time and they have money, and they can literally lawyer you into taking any sort of a plea, assuming that it's built on a foundation. And, you know, before we get to your business topic for the seafood lover in you, a buddy of mine I used to work in a radio newsroom with, he would look at a case like this, shake his head and look at me, and he would say, Paulie, you're going to get caught. It may take a while, but not everybody's going to keep their mouth shut. And whether it's Diamantis, allegedly, we have to be fair, or John Rowland, or, you know, people in local politics, Bridgeport, hello. It's amazing that... I don't know what takes over, Terry, like you said. Maybe it's grandeur, maybe it's power, maybe it's a gambling addiction. But, you know, I would never consider doing this. And even if I did, there'd be a little voice in my head saying, don't do it, because you're going to get caught eventually.
Yeah, because what happens is, especially if you're a public official, eventually you're going to tick somebody off.
Yeah.
You're going to do something, and somebody's going to – and that person – it's going to say, hey, you know, you don't deserve to be treated this way. And then they might rat you out. You know, there's just so many possibilities if you're into public corruption. It's not like being in the mob or something, you know, where people are afraid of you, that you know, going to break your kneecaps or something. This is different. So I look forward to the trial, but the feds have a very high conviction rate. So
sure.
It's very likely that Diamantis will be convicted of something very serious.
Yeah, they don't file cases. They don't think they can win. And finally, Mr. Cowgill, on your list of stuff, we go to the culinary world. Red Lobster making quite the news over the past couple of days.
Yeah, you know, well, they filed for bankruptcy. They had like $1 billion in debt and less than $30 million in cash. And they had, they have like 578 restaurants across the United States and Canada, but and about $2 billion in sales. But of course, a lot of things have passed them by, and you know, there's just a lot of problems associated with the legacy, what I call the legacy restaurant business.
Yeah.
But my point in looking at this is, guess who owns Red Lobster now? It is a private equity firm.
What a shock.
You know? And, yeah, you know how much I love private equity firms. Cause the business model is they do this to not only...
newspapers. Newspapers.
Yeah, I was going to say, the company that owns Waterbury Hospital, they did the same thing. But and Alden Capital, which is a large hedge fund, which essentially owns a bunch of newspapers. They own Gannett. And was the largest. I believe it's still the largest newspaper chain in the country. Mm-hmm. But they buy these things, and they just run them into the ground. They look for very short term profits. They typically sell the property, sell the building, and so that provides a nice boost to all of their shareholders. But then they have to start paying rent on all of those properties, which increases their operating costs. And they basically just run everything into the ground.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you know, they're all of their cronies and people, they walk away richer than they were when it started. It really is a travesty, I think. That is essentially what happened to Red Lobster, along with some trends in the restaurant business, which were just inevitable for something like that to go under.
And you know what happens, you know, and we've seen this, Terry, where these, you know, these private equity firms, they come swooping in and they say, well, no bank is going to deal with you. We'll give you the money, but this is why the banks are all laughing. Terry, my chief concern here, though, is, for the jobs and whatever, but I really pray that Red Lobster survives and Olive Garden, too, because what would America be without Cheddar Bay biscuits and endless and endless breadsticks? I mean, what are we going to do?
And lobster tails. Did you know that 1 in 5 lobster tails purchased in North America is bought by Red Lobster?
Wow.
I mean, that's astonishing.
That's a serious issue. 20%. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So we'll have to find another place to get your lobster tails.
Yeah, right. And of course, those breadsticks at Olive Garden. Terry Cowgill, you can see him at the Connecticut News Junkie and also at Substack.com, Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Mr. Cowgill, have a good week. Go easy on the lobster tails, and we'll chat with you next week. Thank you, sir.
All right, very good. Take care.
All right, thank you, Terry. Always a good cornucopia of topics there with Terry Cowgill.